Well, it is good to be here. And am I on?
You are.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Yeah, please let me know if my voice doesn't come through clearly. The topic today is, speaking to one another. So I am going to speak less so that we can speak to one another more. And Tom and Bob and others put in a lot of time, as well as the press church, to get these tables out so that we could be in a format that I know is very, very dear to someone's heart over there, that we do not miss this opportunity, to talk to one another and to talk to one another vigorously, because in some way that is what I want to bring to our the conversation about our conversation. What I plan to do, and a lot of this comes from my time at Pacifica, even though I wouldn't call myself a mythologist, I taught in the mythology program all 11 of the years I taught at Pacifica, and so some of it rubbed off on me. And so I'm going to begin by telling you a story that is actually at the level of myth, a particular kind of story. It's a story that talks of how, I don't know if those of you who are now, I'm now 76, I tell you every year I could notice that my mind does not process the same way as it did as when I was younger. So I have notes. So what I'd like is to talk of how we might work this story. Maybe work it very much in a Jungian way, work it in a Pacifica way, so that we can discover some of the depths of conversation within ourselves. And how, in particular, now as we're about the eighth week of this program, how compassion has been working in us. So I thought for a while, what do I know from mythology that speaks of compassion, or compassion in some way being central to a moment? And the story that came to my mind was that of Percival, or Parsifal. And so what I'm going to do is tell you the story, talk about some of the themes that I want to bring forward, and then tell you the story again in a way that I want to invite you to a kind of active imagination with the story. There are two principal characters in the story, and you might choose in the active imagination to be one or the other. So you can start letting your heart tell you which one you're drawn to more today. So this is the first telling of the story. It is told that once was born the youngest of three boys, Percival by name. His two older brothers, eager to distinguish themselves as knights of the realm, went out and died at a young age. His mother, fearful that the same fate might fall on her son Percival, kept him apart and reared him deep in the Welsh woods. At the age of 15, however, he happened to chance upon a bunch of knights moving through the forest. And their demeanor and their whole presence drew him. And he left home. There's stories about his mother either fainting or dying, but we won't touch that today. So he leaves home. He proves himself worthy of knighthood. He proves himself worthy as a warrior, and he joins the Knights of the Round Table. Among the many versions of this story is that at that time, the land was a wasteland. So much so that T.S. Eliot took it as the theme for one of his great poems years later, centuries later. The cause of all of this dryness and deterioration in the land was that the king, known either as Fisher King or Grail King, was crippled. He was wounded. And there he sort of like waited for a healing. One day, Parsifal was invited by a fisherman he came upon to have some lodging for the night. And this was no mean lodging. It was the castle of the Grail King. And so he goes into the presence of this wonderful castle, and he notices that this fisherman was himself the Grail King. He was moved to compassion as he saw the sickly, the pained Grail King. But while there, he found that he could go no further than to feel the compassion. He gets the sense that there is a question he should ask, but he has been schooled quite well by his mother to be socially compliant, and so he halts that impulse. And what was the question that was so difficult for him to ask? It is, what ails the king? What ails the king? He dilly-dallies around. He enjoys the castle of the Grail and goes to sleep in the lodgings provided for him. When he wakes up the next morning, all is gone. The king is gone, the castle is gone, and his opportunity has gone. And he finds out that the legend is that if he had asked the king, not only would the king be healed by the asking, but the whole land would also be healed. Wow. Quite a story. Incidentally, this story has been the basis not only of the Wasteland, that, but many other, operas, Parsifal. And it also was the basis of The Natural. Parsifal, if anything, is a natural. He is not a cerebral. He is somebody who is very much in his body. Well, there are very many variations of the story, and this story came out that I took the skeleton of as early as the 12th century, and it was in a writing by Chrétien de Troyes. There were many versions later, and he morphed into Galahad. So you might know him more in terms of Galahad, where Galahad was the son of Lancelot. You know, sort of really deep into who's who in the Knights of the Round Table. But what I'd like to do today is to look at this mythically. And what I think is true about a mythic story is that it contains many short pieces that tell us about things that are typical to being human. Not necessarily all honorable or exalted, but that they are typical. Now, we call those little short moments, I like to think of them as like a little video that might be on, thing on YouTubes, you know, they're memes, M-E-M-E-S. The reason that YouTube videos take off so virally is they capture something that we resonate with. And we either resonate with it to make fun of something that's a human condition, or it's something that we know is timely to our own lives. So this has many different memes in it. That's what I think of as little bits of experience that are preciously human. And so does this story. And one of them is that this Percival, who is, you know, sort of like very much the young boy, he is represents what is pure in us, what's untried in us, even though he was a warrior in the conventional sense. He has this ability to be moved, whether it is at the sight of a group of knights marching through the woods and lets him, you know, break with mother, or at the sight of the wounded king. So in the retelling of the story, when I do the retelling, you might let yourself remember a time when you too were moved deeply and maybe almost paralyzed by that move. He is there in a moment of pure compassion, and it is said by one author that this was a man who rode his horse with slack reins. I'm married to one of those, those of you who know Don, who rides his horse with slack reins, not uptight. What does he also represent? Well, he is androgynous, as many of these knights were. The damsels didn't get to be heroes in those days, so next best thing was to have sort of an androgynous male. So even though it's cross-gender, you can identify with him in the story really quite easily. Thirdly, he, I think, represents doubt in us. I think I've told you in previous times that one of my greatest moments of grace was when a professor at Pacifica told me, when I had written glibly in a sentence, and doubtless blah, blah, blah is true, he wrote, "Should we ever be without doubt?" He represents what stops us from letting compassion move to deeper action. Here, this is represented by his not asking that question, "What ails the king?" You know, when we were young, or when the human is young, they are not yet conditioned by society. And so they're noted for blurting out the truth. As, for example, the emperor has no clothes. In one of the texts I consulted, they said we could call that beginner's pluck. But when we reach youth, 15 years, by this time he most likely was 20 because he had gone through a whole, you know, night's school. We reach a time when social propriety holds us back. So here he is in the presence of a king. Even though the king is wounded, he cannot find it in himself to meet him human to human and ask the question. He's held back by propriety, as maybe most of us would be held back. Who am I to say to someone older than me, you know, what ails you? But there's a price, and the price is that the king does not get healed and the land remains a wasteland. A few more things about myth. In this group, we spent a few years ago a lot of time with the topic of non-dualism. And I think that myths are mined for their story because they are so profoundly non-dualistic. And here, I would point that out in that in this myth, the seeker, Percival, is the same as the sick king. They are one. They're two sides of a coin. One who is young and able, and the other who is older and vulnerable. Also, the king and the land are one. You cannot have a king thriving and his land a wasteland, or vice versa. You could say that a myth is like liquid. It liquefies our rigid notions of this and that. I think it recapitulates what Rachel told us about the Buddhist notion of compassion, that it comes out of a realization of our radical oneness, the oneness of all being. And it is a realization that all loving beings are part of a single entity. In this particular myth, we can look at the king who has this gorgeous castle, and in that castle is the Grail. And if anything else, the Grail represents, you know, having arrived. It was, most radically, the Grail was the cup that caught the blood of Jesus from while he was on the cross. And so Joseph of Arimathea is very much mixed up in this story, but we won't go there. It also represents maybe the chalice that Jesus used at the Last Supper. So it is deeply in symbolism as a kind of ultimate. And this king has this Grail in his almost immediate possession. But he is waiting passively to be asked a loving question. Sometimes that's where we are too, you know, in our pain. So we could say that the Grail is not a quest to win love, as it's sometimes represented in Hollywood, but it's rather a quest to give love. And that the Parsifal version of the Grail myth is primarily a story of a failed opportunity to bless. And I just find myself overcome right now with the thought of Roberta, you know. And so I'm going to just stop for a second and bless her and ask her to bless us. Because she's pretty close to where all blessings come from. So now, the story a second time. What I'm going to suggest that we do here is that I'll tell the story pretty much the same as before, a little bit more differently. And then at the completion of that, for you to take a few moments to just be quiet and notice what has moved in you. And then there will be magically appearing at your table a list of questions. So you could appoint somebody in your group to be the one who sort of just makes sure that there is sort of equal sharing of time among people, you know, that's your role. Your role isn't to be the leader, but more the sort of controller of energy. And you might volunteer for that job as you come back. Okay, so let's see. Any other questions? We haven't done much of this in this group, so I'm aware of that. And yet I'm aware that when one lets oneself sort of fall into story, the thing that is so powerful about it is that we haven't sort of determined what the good outcome would be. Something happens. Grace. Something falls into place by being open to the story. This is what we call letting the story work on us. So, again, Parsifal, 12th century story. It is told that once there was born the youngest of three boys, Parsifal by name. His two older brothers, eager to distinguish themselves as knights of the realm, died an early death. His mother, fearful that the same might fall on Percival, kept him apart and reared him in the Welsh woods. At the age of 15, he is drawn by seeing a group of nuns, a group of knights. Wowee! For those of you who might feel out of this, I was a nun for 20 years. And I think one of my Parsifal moments was the moment when I had to join those nunny-looking people because something moved in me. A group of knights passing through the woods, and he leaves home, and he proves his worthiness as a warrior and joins the Knights of the Round Table. Among the many versions of this is that the land is a wasteland and that the cause of the dryness and deterioration is that the king, called the Fisher King, or also called the Grail King, is wounded and his wound will not heal. One day, Percival comes across a fisherman, and this fisherman offers him some lodging. He finds himself in the castle of the Grail King, for the fisherman is no other than the Fisher King himself. Because of his purity and sensitivity, he recognizes the Grail King, and at the sight of his crippledness, he is filled with compassion. Parsifal is not lacking in feeling, for he is a polite young man, well-trained by the culture of his time. But he cannot bring himself to ask a question that demands so wrenching courage. What ails the king? He dilly-dallies around. He finally goes to sleep. And lo and behold, he wakes and the castle and the king are gone. And so is his opportunity. He has learned that the courage and compassion in asking the question would have healed the Fisher King and also the land. As we stay with this story, we might notice whether or not that there might be in our lives someone, a parent, a spouse, a friend, a congressman, that might need to be asked the question, what ails you? I'm going to ask you to allow the compassion that you might feel as you heard the story to expand. That is, allow it space in your body and move as much as possible from the head down into the body. As we linger at this moment, of Parsifal coming into the presence of the crippled Fisher King. If you are Parsifal, see if the compassion prompts a question. Or if no question, see if you can just contain the frustration of a place that many of us have had, of feeling full of compassion and immobilized because we do not know which way to go. But you might find yourself have been drawn more to be the Fisher King. And it might be that you would want to deepen how it feels to depend on the goodness and the insight of another. To be radically dependent, as much of the poor and sick are, the insight and compassion of the caregiver. And I'll suggest that we have about 3 minutes of time like this, and then we'll have time to be in the group. And at that time, these questions will miraculously appear at each table. Okay. I think every table has a... Yes, you don't have one yet. Okay, John is right behind you. So anyone might read the first question. Excuse me, but take about another minute to bring the discussion to a close, and then we'll have whatever wants to come out to the group as a whole using the microphone up until we break then for our snack. Okay, just before we break for refreshment, there might be some groups that want to talk a little about the experience of the group. I would ask you, don't ask questions at this time, but take something from your experience in the group to share with the rest of the with the rest. Yes. Yeah, it might cause more problem. But I have some more material for the second half, but I can allow more time in the second half if I get the sense that people would like more conversation in the second half. So there's a little piece I want to go over, and then we'll have some more time, and you can pick up the conversation. Anybody who wants to share some of what's happening so far in your group? Time? I think we have a couple minutes before 11. Maybe we could. At least that's what I was planning for. But I'd like at least 2 minutes of this, and then we'll break for... Can we start with you?
Well, can I
yeah.
Yeah. You can tell it, these stories at any microphone. It doesn't matter that one or this one. I'll just say that I had a Parseval experience I was sharing with our group yesterday around lunchtime, walking into Vaughn's to pick up a quick lunch, and there was a homeless man sitting next to a bench. And I looked at him as I walked by, and I thought, gee, I wonder if he's hungry. I wonder if I could pick up something for him, too. But I kept whizzing by because I was on a tight schedule, and I didn't get anything. And I came by, and he was still there. And it was one of these things, you know, you're speechless. So I think if that's common, a lot of people have Parseval moments. Yeah.
Going to blow your mind. I went to Vaughn's. I saw that homeless man sitting on a wall, but he turned to me and he said, "Can you help me?" And I said, "What do you need?" And he said, "I'm hungry. I want to get a burrito." And I said, "How much does it cost?" And he said, $7. And I said, "All right, I will go with you." And I went with him, and he did get a burrito. But don't worry about it. He got fed. You see his eyes on the sparrow. No, I don't know what I would have done if he hadn't spoken to me first. I might have walked right by him. You said, he said, he asked me the question, "Can you help me?" So I answered the question. I did not ask the question. But that's what our table was talking about a lot, how we don't, we get a little choked up. We don't know what questions to ask. We don't know whether we're going to be intrusive or whether we're going to be intruded upon. And by the time we think about it more, the opportunity is over. We spoke mainly on that whole idea of how it is hard to know what questions to ask. We also spoke about how life changes in later life. Our children move home, much to our surprise and not entire pleasure. And we find we can't ask our children the same questions as we did when they were little children. We are looking at new questions. And sometimes the questions are far more important than the answers. Sometimes there do not need to be any answers. The question answers itself. But we have to know what questions to ask. And so in that moment of hesitation sometimes, the whole opportunity passes by to ask what might have been just the right question. But never mind, because the opportunities come back. Yes.